Hello, and welcome to NDT Now's podcast, Level Up. I'm your host, Mary Beth Michelli. Today's podcast is brought to you by Edify Technologies, the world leader in advanced non-destructive testing solutions designed to always keep you beyond current. For more information, visit edify.com. For those of you joining us for the first time today, our Level Up podcast is like a virtual mentoring session with some of the top level threes in the world. And just to be clear, this podcast and any information provided herein is not intended to be formal training. On today's podcast, we have Greg Weaver, who has over 30 years experience in non-destructive testing and quality control. He's also the founder of Weaver NDT and is an ASNT and NAS410 level 3 in RT, including film, CR, DR, CT, and X-ray diffraction, as well as penetrant testing. He is also a level 2 in MT, VT, and ET. Additionally, he is an expert in acoustic resonance testing, which will be our topic of discussion today. Greg, thanks for being here today.
Good to be here, Mary Beth.
So I have to say, I'm personally intrigued to learn more about acoustic resonance testing. As an engineer who works in the bridge industry, getting structures to vibrate at their resonant frequency is something we like to avoid at all costs. For our listeners who haven't seen the Tacoma Narrows Bridge video, you can find it. You can find out why by Googling and watching that video. We try to avoid that as much as possible. So I'm particularly interested to hear about acoustic resonance testing and how resonant frequency can be used for good. So can you explain the basics to us?
Well, the basics is, like in your video, you excite a structure. And when that structure gets excited at its natural frequency or at its resonance, then there's movement that comes with that excitation. Different frequencies have different types of movement. So you want to excite a part, capture that resonance response, and record that, and then use that data for an analysis. That's the it in a nutshell.
Interesting. And so can you tell us a little bit about when that's applicable or when this is being used?
Sure. So we do a lot of testing at initial manufacturing. So we're looking at components from very, very small. I've done a lot of dental implant type of testing using this technology up to large structures that are in castings of several hundred pounds and some to thousands of pounds. It just depends on the setup. In each of those cases, though, you excite the component, you get it to respond. As I said, you capture those resonances and you try to capture a full spectrum of resonances, as each resonance has a different shape associated with it, a mode shape of excitation. You capture multiple frequencies so that you can understand maybe a different reaction in a different location, as it'll represent itself in that mode that's excited at that point. So you excite a part, you capture a spectrum of resonances, and that digital resonance can then be used for analysis. It can be used for comparative testing to maybe a sample set that you already had recorded that you knew was acceptable. And you then compare that for a very quick pass fail of those, you know, differences that you see in that resonance spectrum.
So I guess that was one of my questions then. So is it necessary to have sort of a baseline where you have something that you know is a good sample that you test first, and then you have to compare then the other samples to the original?
That's the best situation, right? When you have something that is known and there's a collective sample of, say, you know, statistically valid representation of what they believe is acceptable in their product, then yes, you can sample that with our technology, or you could use a database as a sample or a model. A lot of people will model as many variations as they can assume in their process, and then provide us that data, and then we will provide the actual resonance response from their part and see how that correlates. I do a lot of testing where people don't know what they have in their sample, and they just say, here's 100 parts. Can you tell us what's deviant, what's not, what's consistent? Many times I sell this product when I'm out in the field as not as a non-destructive tool, but as a quality tool where you're just looking for consistency of product. And mm-hmm. and maybe you'll use, you know, four or five of the modes and the resonances so that you capture all these different structural movements and you contain those within a process and you say, this is a consistent product that you sell in the end. Not really knowing exactly what's wrong with it, but knowing that it's consistent with your other product that you're producing.
And so since you're looking for these differences, are you all using AI and machine learning to look at the data, or is this more of a manual review of the different frequencies?
Well, there's various ways to do it. There's standard software packages where, as you said, if you have a known sample, you'll just put in limits, highs and lows, and you'll record that and it'll automatically generate, you know, a pass fail or conform, non-conform, whatever your terminology is. There is AI being used to understand if you have a certain mode that's critical for some application and that they change something in their process, knowing that it's going to affect that mode, then that AI can then automatically adjust the tolerancing and the testing as you go forward. And another application I've seen where, due to field use and due to serviceability issues that have happened post, in service, they then model that and use AI to understand those changes or predicted changes. And then we look for that in the testing as well.
That's cool. That's a great use. So can you tell us who's performing this kind of testing? Because I'll tell you, before I read your LinkedIn post, I had never really heard of this. So then I was very interested.
Sure. There's some people using this that, a lot of manufacturers use it. So the primary manufacturer that uses this is Centered Metal. So any powdered centered metal manufacturer, if they're producing parts in, there are certain automotive primes and certain aerospace primes that if they're using that particular process, they have said you can, resonance testing is an approved NDT method for that testing. So if you have to do 100% testing, any of those primes can then put it on a spec and you could reference it and use it. There's also any complex part that is being manufactured in casting or forging. We see it quite a bit in use there. We see it in additive manufacturing more and more as that, becomes mm-hmm. more available. And as people, I don't know how many manufacturers we have out there, but if you have 15 machines producing the same product, you may get 15 different products off of those machines, even though they're under one spec. So looking at the uniformity of that has become very interesting for some manufacturers to make sure that it's all uniform within some tolerance across all 15 machines. So it's becoming more relevant in that industry. Probably that's the biggest growth industry we see at this point.
Interesting. So, and you had mentioned some specs, but are there standards like ASTM standards out there for this kind of testing or other standards that dictate how it needs to be done?
There's the general guide is an ASTM standard. It's a resonant ultrasound spectroscopy for defect detection of both metallic and non-metallic parts. That's E2001. And then there's also a fairly new one that just came out in the last round, and it is specific to one particular type, this impulse excitation, so that excitation of the part, and that's E3397, and that's literally this year just came out, it's brand new, and that's the standard practice for resonance testing using the impulse excitation method, and that's the newest and most relevant for us anyway, because that's something now that everybody can now put on their specs to reference for a standard. Before it was a guide, now it's a standard or a practice.
So that's really interesting for people to know. I know it's sometimes hard to keep up on all the ASTM standards.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's so many.
Yeah. I'm on a committee and I still can't keep up with them all. So So you mentioned this a little bit, but the groups that are specifying this as an alternative to conventional NDT, I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit about what kind of NDT was being used before on these parts.
Sure, sure. So I've seen resonance replace NDT methods. I've seen it replace X-ray, I've seen it replace penetrant, and I've seen it replace ultrasonic. And all three of those cases are not some, you know, standard uniform thing that you can use as a replacement, right? Because most of those inspections are very specific to location and area of interest and things like that. And you have, right, X-rays internal, penetrants external, right? And then UT, you can use a combo of that for those methods. So when you see it replaced with resonance, you see, so resonance is a whole body, right? So when I excite that and I get those different modes, in the end, with a lot of data and understanding, I can start to correlate those modes to a particular area or a particular defect type. But that takes quite a bit of data and it takes quite a bit of understanding. But initially, you just know there's a difference. So when you see replacement, it's because somebody is more worried about, you know, an issue in service or something material related, because material relationships and resonance go hand in hand, right? If you change a material type or you add something new to that, we're going to see that difference. Where an X-ray, it's going to be blind for the most part, mm-hmm. penetrant as well. UT, you'll see some differences in velocity maybe, and you'll start to, you could probably pick that up. You may not know why it's there, but you would know there's a difference. So, you know, ultimate replacement is probably not something that would happen, but getting your part tested with a whole body response when you're worried about a structural integrity of something, particularly something that's, you know, critical, that's where you see the usage. In, you know, it's not spec'd as often as it should be. Let's put it that way, from my perspective. The biggest thing we haven't talked about is speed. This test takes about 5 seconds. So it's very, very fast.
And that was what I was going to ask. So, I would assume from, you know, in my industry, we have what I call global monitoring and local monitoring, right? So we have something called operational modal analysis, and it gives you the whole behavior of the structure in a matter of like 2 hours. Whereas, and it'll tell you, okay, we have an issue in this sort of area. And then you can go in with a more local monitoring system, whether it's strain gauges or, you know, tilt meters or accelerometers, and then determine what the actual issue is on a smaller level that maybe you can then put into a model and, you know, help determine what the problems are. So, so now you're speaking in my language, I'm getting it more. So this is sort of a global, you know, I won't call it monitoring, but you can globally understand what's going on. And then at that point, you could take parts out, right, that quickly that are not part of the, in the acceptable range.
That's right. Yeah. So if, to go back into your world, the interesting thing is I have had applications that are still going through an initial process of understanding where, in your world, if I'm testing a bridge or a dam or whatever I'm testing in that structure, if I repetitively test that using this test method and I have that categorized and that data recorded, then I can always compare my new data set to the old data set and just look for a delta of change, right? So to your point, if you are using a global test and you're going to go back in and use strain gauges and you're going to use or localized modal analysis, if you continued to do that on some regular interim, right, you would be able to find those changes outside of your global monitoring at some level, you know, and maybe one's better than the other and maybe it's not, but it's still very much the same. If you put a strain gauge in place, but, or you test it with this type of equipment, you're going to get a very similar result, because those are things we do find. Stress and strain are another thing that's very unique to this process that you don't really find with other NDT methods, right? We can find residual stresses in parts that are, you know, engine turbine components or even in additive components, right? If they're built on a plate and once they remove them, if they're not heat treated properly, we can find that type of thing. So there's unique little niches like that that are really outside of the world of what currently is being used in the NDT field that I think you kind of get in one package. And that's why it can be a struggle to say this is the defect of interest that you're looking for, or this one is different than, you know, the other parts that you're producing or the other things that you're doing. So
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it's different. It's different. You know, you got to kind of wrap your head around something a little different. You know, most people, when they think of resonance that are in UT, you know, UT, there's a lot of different resonance tools, right? It's always a localized resonance, though. So you're placing that probe in one spot and you're looking for a resonance difference change. And it's very, you know, for composites and things like that, it's very good. And you can then localize the resonance change to that particular area. What we're doing is getting a global response, and the sensitivity may change because we're trying to interpret, you know, the whole body of that surface where they're looking for one difference. But I've never done a study to understand if we're just as sensitive to that as well. But I couldn't identify it where they could. So there's lots of interesting stuff happening when you think of resonance. It fits in the ultrasonic world.
Right, right. Well, and I imagine that this kind of information that you're providing sort of bridges that gap between the NDT folks and the engineering folks in the overall manufacturing, because they can relate to the sort of residual stress and why that's important, and knowing that sort of thing and getting the global view of what's going on as a system, basically, versus individual parts being okay or not okay and looking for flaws.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of different, you know, fingers to the technology where we focus on. We have some areas where it's just mechanical properties, where we're trying to use that same data set to predict fatigue or tensile or compression failures. And that correlation is usually very good, but you couldn't identify it out. You wouldn't know if it was defective, right? But when someone runs a controlled sample, I just performed one of these for an additive company where they've, you know, purposely built in porosity, or, you know, they're building lattices that maybe they've on purpose, you know, caused one to be thinner, one to be maybe missing one or whatever. You can see that some of the frequency data, not all of it, because some of it's global, but particular ones are a perfect correlation in some cases to that failure mechanism. So they can then, either depending on the regulation and the requirements they're held to, they could reduce the amount of destructive testing they're doing and use the non-destructive testing to replace that destructive testing. Because once they prove the correlations, then you can do that. So those are very different types of things that you normally don't hear in NDT, but those are things we're doing every day.
Yeah, that's excellent. And you can really, as we're talking about this, you can really see the cost savings in the manufacturing process to using this kind of testing.
Yeah, I think some of the, you know, it's hard to get over the hump for when you just talk about regular NDT sometimes, because, you know, methods are mandated, right? You have to use, and there's a cost, it's not free. So you have to somehow, you know, so in the, I'll just use one example, in the turbine blade repair world, when parts come in the door, you typically do an X-ray and an FPI to screen out the stuff you don't think you can repair. And then at the end of the process, you got to do that X-ray and FPI again, because you've done something to the part, right? So in some cases, we have replaced that initial inspection. Right? So there's no reason to have, you know, that X-ray and that, and time-wise, like I said, it's 5 seconds, right? We're not shooting X-rays, and we're not waiting on dwells, and people aren't interpreting that. It's just a data set, and it passes and fails, and you move on. That's one example where the cost savings is big. Another one is if you think about some of the longer scanning CT things that are out there in the world today, someone produces a complex part, even if it takes you 20 minutes to scan it, which I know people are scanning for hours. If you could pre-screen that and scan, even if you just prioritize what you're scanning, most likely to pass, you know, probably will pass and might fail. We've found some real success there in getting people to help their production flow go through expectations. You know.
So I guess that leads me to one more question. So are people purchasing the equipment and having people run it within their manufacturing facility, or are they outsourcing this as a service to people, for people to
It
do?
happens both ways, and there are other excitation methods. I worked at a company for 11 years that used a ultrasonic transducer to excite, and then they would receive that resonance with the transducer. That particular system is not sold. That's service only type of work. Or they place a system on your floor there, and then they get paid for that service over either per piece or per month or whatever they agree to. The impulse systems, there's actually quite a few different vendors that supply that. I of course think the one we use is the best because we have good software tools. Software is really the key, right? The sensitivity and definition of what your frequencies are, the relationships sometimes between those frequencies are very critical. But I do both. I have service work. I have service. I just did some service work this morning. What normally happens is a customer says, "Does this work? We heard about it. Here's a sample set." Once you validate that, then they can purchase that and then put that in the facility. And then once it goes into a facility, you normally don't hear about their new applications or what they're using it on. They'll share data sometimes and say, "What do you think of this?" and things. But for the most part, there is an initial service, and then it's a system sale, and it goes out into the field. And normally, depending on the application, it's the engineering group that's running it, not the NDT people that are running
And that's what I was going to ask. So, are there any, there's no certification for this, or, I mean, it's just training, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of both right now. Most of the automotive applications, and that's probably, 85% of the business, maybe 90, and some other industrial, manufacturers. None of those are in a, there's some training, but it's not certification. So you're qualified, but you're not certified. And basically, once everything is in, if you're not setting up the test and setting up that pass, it is a, you can just make it an instrument reading where it's a lot of it's done by robots. A lot of it's done on the line. Once it's established and once they figure out how to handle the part, put the part in position, and then move the part, then it becomes a robotic system. But in the aerospace side, I have seen, especially on the additive, and ASTM is really starting to come up with, on the additive ASTM side, the F42 group, there's two or three different up and coming specifications that will include resonance inside of their qualifications, as an acceptable inspection method. So that'll have all the other methods. But in that acceptable method, it does call out to have a UT level 3 responsible for the program, and then certified personnel underneath them to do perform the test. So it's
Oh,
coming
interesting.
in certain applications under certain criticality, I believe you will see where it's re required.
And are they calling out, because that's for Aero, is that are they calling out NAS410, or are they calling out SNT TC1A, or?
Well, you know how ASTM, they call out everything a little bit, but very interesting. In the bottom of one of the specs, it was specific to NAS410.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think just because they assume the programs are going to be NAS410, right?
Right,
So,
right.
but there is no additional call out for anything beyond your resonance experience you would gain as a level three to get that UT, right? You don't need to have that. So, like many things in NAS410, right? There's film and non-film. You can do a whole lot of non-film and never be exposed to it and still be responsible for a program you've never, seen. Yeah. The fun world of a level three of different areas.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining us today and bringing this information to our listeners, and to me. I think it was a very interesting topic, and I'm sure there'll probably be some additional questions. And I know you're on LinkedIn and people can find you there. And then what's your website URL?
The website is www.weaverndt.com.
All right, thank you.
You bet.
So if you have any further questions, reach out to Greg. I'm sure he would be happy to share his immense knowledge with you. And thank you all for listening today. Remember, you can join us every month here at ndtnow.com, brought to you by Edify Technologies. Learn more at edify.com.